Welcome everybody to week two of Los Pensadores, the philosophers, the Jewish philosophers of medieval Spain. I just like saying pensadores, so I'm just going to say that as much as I can. Welcome to week two. We're going to be discussing Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, as we did last week, as well as Rabbeinu Nissim, also known as the Ran. I'm just going to make sure people know this is a 3-week series, then we have 1 week off, and then we have our November series. November series is the House of David. We'll be talking about three kings from the Davidic dynasty, each of whom had quite the adventurous career. We're going to start with Shlomo, King Solomon, and then move on to Rehoboam, who was the king of the Civil War, and then we'll go on from there to Josiah. So that'll be a November series. Also, I think I mentioned at the when we had the session before Rosh Hashanah, that I have a fellow here in my Beit Midrash program who is interested in giving an afternoon class at some point. So I'm going to send out email. Part of today's follow-up email will be a question just about people's interest and topics and so forth. But it'll be a brand new option by Zoom. As always, thank you everybody for registering. Those who have not yet had a chance to pay, you can still do so. We have no time limit on that. If you're not getting the emails, please let me know. I did send out a follow-up one last week with the link to the recording and intend to do the same thing today. So before we got started, Janine asked a question regarding interaction between these Spanish, the Spanish philosophers and Spanish Jewry, Sephardi Jewry in general, and the Ashkenazim. So I mentioned with the Rashba, with Rabbi Ibn Aderet, that he received questions from Jews who were living in Ashkenazi lands. He had quite a bit of interaction. In his time, Rabbeinu Asher moved, escaping persecution in Germany, moved to Spain, and he helped him get set up in Toledo as the leading rabbi in the community there. He had a lot of interaction. From the previous series we had about Spanish Jewry and Sephardic Jewry in June, when we talked about Nachmanides, Ramban, we said also that he learned from authors of the Tosfot who were Western Europe. So you definitely had interaction between the groups. Certainly at this stage, you're post-Crusades, so it's a lot easier for that to happen. Okay, so last time round, after we dealt with Rabbi Ibn Aderet's biography, and we introduced the Jews of 13th century Spain, we started talking about the external battles that he fought, and specifically his polemic against Ibn Khazm and the Ibn Khazm's attacks on Judaism, which were, you know, 2 centuries old by that time. And we suggested that Rashba, Rabbi Ibn Aderet, is really writing to counter the Christian polemics of his day. That's really what he's doing. He's writing about the Christians, but it's a lot easier to say it about a 200 years dead Muslim writer than to say it about the church in his day. Having said that, he did debate Christians as well. And I gave you, if you look at the sheet, and I put the link in the chat again, if you look at source number 1, this is a piece of a responsum of his, in which Rabbi Solomon, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, records the disputation that he had with somebody from the church. Unclear exactly who it is who he was debating. But he records it and publishes it, as you see here in source number 1, to teach the people of Judah to answer statements with true statements and to write justly. It appeared just in my eyes to write before you regarding that which someone told me, that one of the Ishmaelite scholars spoke in the community on the day of gathering, and he filled ears with his words. And you asked me to give you answers for his words. Therefore, I have seen fit to record in text the dispute one of their scholars had with me regarding those matters. Let me pause there. Which word in the paragraph I just read did not make any sense? There's one word there that clearly doesn't belong. Ishmaelite, exactly, Linda. Ishmaelite doesn't belong. He's living in Christian Spain in the 13th century, the time of the Reconquista, where the Christians are battling the Muslims who are in southern Spain and taking back territory. There's no Ishmaelite speaking in the public square in northern Spain. What he's doing, yes, Rose.
No, but we said last week that what he's doing is he's using the Ishmaelite as a point of reference in terms of to deal with the discussion with a Christian, with a church.
So that's
what... This is his point of reference, right? When Ishmael comes in and this guy who was 200 years before is in the picture.
So that's true in what he writes about Ibn Hazm. However, here he's talking about a live event. He's talking about a Christian. However, he can't say that. Because it's dangerous, again, in Christian Spain to position yourself as somebody who is disputing Christianity. And, you know, in a disputation, you had to make sure to get a promise of protection if you were going to engage in that, and he doesn't have that here. So he pretends he's debating an Ishmaelite. Not unlike, fast forward to the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, and Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, who writes the halachic work Aruch HaShulchan. And in his Aruch HaShulchan, he has to deal with some laws that relate to non-Jews, and he calls them Egyptians. He lived in Novardok, in Lithuania. He never met an Egyptian. But he's using that in place of Notsrim, Christians. To go from Notsrim to Mitzrim, if you can picture the Hebrew letters, is very easy. So every reader knows who he's talking about. And he's just avoiding problems. So here too, yes, yes, yes.
Didn't you also teach us that the other, I can't remember names, but he published a response. I mean, even though he's promised protection, he got kicked out.
That was Nachmanides. Yeah.
Yeah. So wouldn't that teach you? Nachmanides was before him, if I have my dates right.
Correct. So the thing is that, first of all, Nachmanides, we said last week, was a teacher of Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Adaran. He learned from him directly, and he saw what happened. It's true, and that definitely informs his perspective. What happened there was he was promised protection for the disputation, and then he was bullied afterwards because he published his account of the disputation, which surprisingly wasn't the same as the church's public accounting of the disputation. So that was where he got pushed out. And yes, true. So he is presenting here his responses, with a dispute he had with one of their scholars, not an Ishmaelite scholar, but a Christian scholar. And I skipped some of it, but I brought you an excerpt just so you could see it. He says he, meaning the Christian who's debating with him, tried a different tack. He argued, still, Jacob said, the scepter will not leave the tribe of Judah until the Messiah comes. And it has left. This is a classic that was used consistently by Christians and Muslims against Judaism to argue that the Torah is over. It's not legitimate and it doesn't apply and God has left us. Because when Jacob gives a blessing to his children at the end of his life, the blessing he gives to the tribe of Judah, it's in Genesis chapter 49, says the scepter will not leave the tribe of Judah until the Messiah comes. That's essentially the meaning of the line. You could translate it a little differently, but it's basically that. So that seems to imply that the tribe of Judah will have kings all the way until the time of Mashiach, the Messiah. And that's what this Christian says to Rabbi Ibn Adaret. So he says, I said, my response was, if the prophet Jacob was truly promising that the scepter would not leave Judah until Messiah arrives, then it left ages ago during the Babylonian exile, way before this time, like 1800 years before Rabbi Ibn Adaret, which was long before the Messiah you claim has arrived. You believe in a Christian Messiah, right? The Christian Messiah wasn't around at the time that the scepter left Judah back then. So in other words, this verse may be a problem for me, but it's also a problem for you. So he says, he, the Christian, replied that the scepter did not leave in that exile. There still was a Sanhedrin, a high court that judged capital cases. To which Rabbi Ibn Aderet says, I replied, this is not so, for two reasons. First, they didn't handle capital cases in Babylon. The Jews in the Babylonian exile were not handling cases of life and death. Don't kid yourself. That's number one. Number two, he says, further, Jacob spoke to the tribe of Judah when he said this. Jacob said, the scepter will not leave Judah. The Sanhedrin, the high court, is not exclusively from Judah. There are 71 judges on that. They're not all from the tribe of Judah. It's collected from all Israel, whoever is wise and worthy. So that doesn't fit. So the Christian says to him, well, if so, then according to your words, what will we do with Jacob's prophecy? He's like, okay, fine. Christianity doesn't, you know, isn't predicted by the departure of the scepter from Judah. But what do you do with the line? So he says, it means not the scepter will never leave Judah. It won't leave Judah forever. Meaning, monarchy will come back to Judah with the arrival of the Messiah. That's the way to explain the text. And so, Rabbi Ibn Aderet has provided the Jews of his day with a means of responding to the Christians. I also gave you a link in source number two for a paper, which I'm not going to go into because there's so much more to talk about. But it's a paper on disputations that Rabbi Ibn Aderet had with two members of the church, one of whom was a Christian from birth, and the other one was a Jew who had converted to Christianity. So you can take a look at that. But I wanted to shift gears and talk about the internal battles that Rabbi Ibn Aderet fought. We already have seen that he was fighting battles in terms of adherence to Jewish law and Jewish ethics, right? Do you remember the case we talked about that was sent to him where there was a man who had a maid and he had taken up with the maid and she became pregnant and then he kicked her out of the house and then she came back and she was pregnant again and he didn't know if he was the father or she was involved with somebody else, right? But he was paying support money. Like, that's going on in his day and he is horrified. He was a very strong defender of Jewish law and of Jewish ethics and a traditionalist. So take a look, for example, at source number three. This is another case involving sexual impropriety. Look at this case from a responsum of Rabbi Ibn Aderet. Reuven brought Dinah, daughter of Joshua, into his home with her consent and the consent of her parents, to serve him. They provided their daughter as a maid in his house. And this Reuven, 10 years passed without his wife becoming pregnant, and she had no child. So 10 years have gone by, without becoming pregnant and she had no child. He's borrowing a biblical phrase. It's common in Rabbi Ibn Aderet's writing, as it was in all the Spanish school, to incorporate biblical verses in their text.
Sounds like a Hagar story.
Yeah, it does. But look what happens. The 10 years pass without his wife becoming pregnant, no kid from her. And when Dinah, the maid, was in his house, he seduced her, lay with her, and impregnated her. And that's where you depart from the Hagar story. Hagar is a full-blown wife. This story is decidedly not. So Reuben realizes she's pregnant. He betroths her, and he writes her a ketubah. Keep in mind, this is in a Sephardi country. Ashkenazim had stopped polygamy 300 years before this. But the decree of Rabbeinu Gershom has not necessarily spread. Rabbeinu Gershom was the one who banned it in Ashkenazi communities, has not necessarily spread fully. There's a lot of discussion about that because polygamy was never a highly popular practice, but it was clearly still going on because that's what happens. And Dina's parents agreed to it. The maid's parents said, okay, you ask if the child's lineage is kosher. So the question that's put to Rabbi Ibn Aderet is, is this child legitimate? Or, you know, is there some issue of illegitimacy in this child's lineage? That's the question that he has to address. So, if you look at his answer, you find he's not limiting himself to that issue. He says, before anything else, I must say that this is prohibited and ugly. It is prohibited, for he violates the prohibition of you shall not have a kedesha. You shall not have a kedesha. The word kedesha is used to refer to somebody who is dedicated to sexual immorality for money. That's essentially what a kedesha is. Diane asks in the chat, I always prefer for people to ask questions out loud, but where this verse is, the answer is Deuteronomy chapter 23. Parsha Ki Tetzeh. So I have a verse that says, you shall not have a kedesha, and you shall not desecrate your daughter to turn her to promiscuity. This is a biblical prohibition. And it is ugly. Not only is it prohibited, it's also ugly. Because before the Torah was given, a man and woman would meet in the market, and if they both wanted, then he would lie with her and keep her as a wife, or he would pay her and leave. This is Maimonides' formulation of what marriage looked like pre-Torah, and he's borrowing from Maimonides. Once the Torah was given, new law was created, and one who wishes to marry a woman must hire a videographer and flowers and everything. No, that's not what he says. They didn't have videographers in his day. But there's Kiddushin. You give her a ring and all of that. This is not the way to do things. So he is defender of ethics in a society where it seems to be falling apart. And he is also a powerful conservative voice regarding law. And I brought you what I think is probably everybody's favorite example of the conservatism of Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet in matters of law. This is a fascinating case. It's a very long responsum. I only brought you a tiny piece of it. I need to explain it a little bit. Anybody know what the word trefa means? You've heard the word trefe.
Not kosher.
So that's the way it's used colloquially.
Very sick
was going to die. Right. So Janine gives me the literal meaning, or close to it. The treif is used to mean non-kosher. The original term treifa means an animal which has been torn, an animal which is injured in such a way that it cannot live. Once an animal is mortally wounded, it cannot be kosher. Even if a person performs shechita on it, the animal's not kosher. That's what a trefa is. So the Talmud actually records a list of conditions. Some of them are injuries, like where the animal was attacked. Some of them are illnesses. Some of them are congenital problems, all of which render the animal a trefa. And one of the guiding lines the Talmud seems to give is that if the animal left to its own devices could not live 1 year, the animal is a trefa. You follow? All right, there's a little introduction to kashrut. The vegetarians, I'm sure, are thrilled. The rule is if the animal can't live for 1 year, then it's a trefa. Now, what if an animal can't live for a year, but it doesn't have one of the injuries on the list? That's a great discussion, not for right now. The point is, somebody wrote a letter to Rabbi Ibn Aderet saying, you know, I have an animal that has one of the conditions on the list, but it survived 12 months. How can that be? The Talmud says that if it's a trefa, it's not going to survive more than 12 months. So it's an old problem of science and Torah. We actually discussed this. We had a 6-week session, I think it was 6 weeks, on science and Torah at Beth Emeth. It was, I think it was a winter series a few years ago. So this came up then also, if I remember correctly. Betty, you were there. So look at what he says. He says, it cannot be. He says, it is impossible to argue that this animal could have one of the conditions on the list and yet live 12 months. It's just not so. And if you will reply, he says, in source number 4, if you're going to tell me, what can we do? We have seen a yeteret of the foot survive 12 months. Yeteret is the condition we're talking about. It survived 12 months with our own eyes. He says, yeah, but that's what Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi once told Rabbi Yossi ben Nahorai in the Talmud. He argued, he says, you depend on that? You're bringing me, he's talking about a different context, but you bring me your thing as a proof? That's what I say to you. You think that means anything to me when you talk about what you observed? This is not possible. It is as though you testify that you have seen the impossible. It's just not true. Or, he says, maybe there's another cause. There's another factor involved. So too here, we ask the witness how he knew that this animal had in fact survived that period. Perhaps you forgot or erred. Maybe you made a mistake in your calendar. Or perhaps you were confused regarding the time, or perhaps you confused this animal for another. It is not possible for him to testify this animal was in his sights for the entire 12 months. So something went wrong. And if he will strengthen himself in his error and say, no, for I love these strange words. This is what I saw. This is what I will follow. You insist that this is the way it is. Then we will tell him it is impossible to slander the words of the sages. The witness and 1,000 like him should be canceled. Rather than cancel one point of the positions agreed upon by the holy Jewish sages, the prophets and students of prophets, and statements given to Moses at Sinai, he said, I don't care what you testify, it simply can't be. He is holding the line. Arch-conservative in this regard. Susan does not approve. But that's the stance he takes. And keep in mind the way we set this up last week. He's living at a point in which Judaism is very much under siege. Jews face threats of violence from multiple directions, government, church, peasants. They're dealing with ideas like Aristotelian rationalism that promotes seeing the Torah and the laws of the Torah as allegory and not as literal. He's dealing with social immorality. It's possible. And there are those who will reinterpret a Talmudic passage and say, well, clearly that's not what the Talmud meant. He's having none of that. He says, the Talmud means what it says, and your testimony is wrong. Yes, Susan?
But wouldn't that get people angrier? He knows the animal lives over 12. Like, if you're telling me I'm a liar, and I've seen this, then I would lose faith in your Judaism.
So
I know what happened.
So I don't know what Rabbi Ibn Adaret is actually thinking. Meaning, I don't know if he's taking this stance purely for political purposes to keep the nation in line, or whether he actually believes this must be the way it is. I don't know. It's not, you know, he doesn't stop playing the part at any point in the responsum of the one who believes this. But I could make the argument, and it has been made over the centuries at various times in various communities, that he would feel, and I'm now putting words in his mouth, which I should not do, so let me be very clear. He didn't say the following. But I wonder if there isn't a sense of, let those who don't like the program leave, and everybody else will be loyal. So if they can't take it, let's draw a clear line between those who are good with it and those who aren't good with it. I wonder about that, because that's a stance that we've seen in Jewish history. And again, he didn't say that, but others have, and I wonder how much that fits into this. But I'm going to go further, because it gets better. I wanted to make sure to go back to our opening source where we talked about last week, the opening source from last week, the ban on philosophy in the year 1305. I reproduced it here on the sheet, but we'll get to it in a moment. I want to give a little bit of background. Rabbi Moses Maimonides, also known as Rambam, leading halachic authority of the last 1100 years for sure, author of the major work of Jewish law, the Mishneh Torah, major philosopher as well, author of the work Moreh Nevuchim, Guide of the Perplexed, built very heavily on Aristotelian ideas. He interacted with Muslim philosophers of his day. He was very well versed in Greek philosophy. His medicine, a lot of it was Greek as well. And it made it into his writings. He makes no bones about it. He quotes you, Aristotle. He quotes you other thinkers. He quotes you Muslim thinkers. So that caused a lot of controversy. There were those who were very uncomfortable with it. Earlier than this period, there was what was called the Maimonidean controversy. And then, because we're really original in the way we name things, in the period of the Rashba, you get the second Maimonidean controversy. That's what they call it. There's the original, and then there's version number two. I think there's even version number three later on. But what happened was, there was a rabbi in southern France. His name is Rabbi Abba Murray, but that won't be on the exam. Rabbi Abba Murray in southern France wrote a document against the rationalists who followed Maimonides in his philosophy. And he approached Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, leading halachic authority of the time, and asks him to take up the cause and to ban the reading of philosophy, to ban the reading of Maimonides' philosophy. And Rabbi ibn Aderet wants to sit this one out. He has his concerns about philosophy, but he doesn't think that this is the time to take up the charge. And we have a work, it's called Minchat Kinaot. It's actually available online. If you were to go to HebrewBooks.org, you could find it there. I'm going to put the name of it, the Hebrew name, in the chat. This work, Minchat Kinaot, records the letters that went back and forth between Abba Murray and various sages, prominently Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet in his day, trying to get them to take up the charge. And at one point, he finally does support the ban. And I gave it to you here in source number 5 from Yitzchak Ber. It's his translation, not my own. And as we noted when we discussed this as the opening source, the text that Rabbi ibn Aderet has in his own writing is slightly different. But this is what you see here. From this day on, in the year 1305, and for the next 50 years, no member of our community shall study the Greek works on science and metaphysics, either in the original, i.e. Arabic, or in translation, before he will have reached the age of 25. Nor may any member of our community teach the aforesaid disciplines to anyone under the age of 25, lest these studies draw the student away from the Torah of Israel, which is superior to this other learning. We have exempted from our decree the study of medicine, although it is a natural science, for the Torah has given the physician permission to practice the art of healing. So as we noted when we talked about this in week one, first of all, Rabbi ibn Aderet says that astronomy is also allowed, and that the study of Maimonides' philosophy is also okay. But more, we noted that the document permits it at the age of 25, which is when people normally started to study it anyway. So it's not actually effectively banning anything. But the idea here is, and he ultimately supports it, that there's a concern that this philosophy is going to undermine people's faith. Clear? He was also a believer in mysticism, but not in abusing mysticism. One example of his belief in mysticism comes up in what was a very hot debate in his day. The issue of reasons for the commandments. Understanding why God commanded what God commanded. So that Maimonides is very into this. He gives you reasons for everything. He gives you more than one reason for everything. So for example, when you talk about keeping kosher, Maimonides talks about the concern that there are certain foods that are not healthy. That's not the only explanation he gives, but he gives that explanation, which it survives among people to this day. Right? The sacrificial system in the time of the temple, so Maimonides talks about the idea that Jews lived in a society in which people sacrificed animals, and it would have been bizarre to them if you told them that your service of God is just speaking to God and thinking about God, and they couldn't relate to it. Maimonides gives other explanations, but he mentions that as well. He likes to talk about reasons for mitzvot. Yes, Susan?
Was he the first?
Maimonides? I don't know. I don't know. It's a good question. Susan asks if Maimonides was the first one to make the health and kosher connection. It's hard to say. There's a passage in the Talmud which says that nevela, an animal that dies through something other than shchita, damages the heart. But it's unclear whether it means that physically or spiritually. That's not clear. Does it mean physical, or does it just mean spiritually it's bad for the person's heart, you know, in that sense, not biological? I don't know. Rose?
But that's actually, that's applicable today. Because, am I unmuted?
You are unmuted.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Because, for example, all the shrimps and the lobsters and the things, they're all bottom feeders. And they actually eat, like, the dregs of the ocean. So that is, I know it sounds...
So I'm not going to go into the kosher debate, because we actually had a class on this a while back, on this topic. I think it's maybe, I don't know, in any case. We did talk about this at one point years and years ago. And there's a lot to be said about it, but it's a very dangerous game, this idea that it's about health. You also have a Talmudic passage which talks about eating creepy crawly creatures heating up a person's body. And whether that heat is good for a person, bad for a person. Well, Rabbi Ibn Aderet doesn't want any of this. Not one bit. If you take a look at source number 6 from a responsum of his, he says, even mitzvot, even commandments, which seem to have simple reasons that the Torah presented, and that those reasons are the purpose of the mitzvah, yeah, that reason is not the purpose, he says. The reason is true, but it is one point among the mitzvah's benefits and intentions. When the Torah says to you, do this because, that doesn't mean that that's the only reason. The hidden matters that are hinted within it, to those whom God has graced, have no end. That's where he goes mystical. As King David said, for every perfection I have seen a limit, but your mitzvot are very broad. There's no limit to the mitzvot, meaning to the meaning of the mitzvot. And he gives you an example. He says the mitzvah of Shabbat has its reason explained in Exodus chapter 31, right? You shall halt on Shabbat because God created the world in 6 days, etc. It appears the entire intent of the mitzvah is this and nothing else. As in Deuteronomy chapter 5, therefore Hashem your God commanded you to make the day of Shabbat because he created the world in 6 days. What could be simpler? But with all of that, Shabbat includes a very lofty secret. And even that reason which is revealed to all itself includes matters which entire books could not contain. He says, creation? Oh boy, that's like its own library. So he says, you can never assume that you understand the reason for a mitzvah. Why does he take that view, which is stronger than that of his predecessors? Even Nachmanides, his mentor, who was not a fan of assigning reasons for mitzvot, did not go as far as Rabbi Ibn Aderet did. Why does he insist that you can't identify reasons for mitzvot? Think about the philosophy of it. So I'll make suggestions because we're short on time. Number one, this fits an overall conservative view that says, do what God told you to do. Right? Don't try to be smart. God said, do this, you do this. God said, don't do that, don't do that. That's number one. Number two, it fits into his suspicion of the dangers of philosophy. He doesn't want you getting involved in philosophy. But more than that, and the Professor David Sirotskin makes this point, I brought it for you in source number 7. He says, more than that, there is a fear of Christian influence. Meaning, if we can give reasons for mitzvot, the church can also give reasons for mitzvot. We're human, they're human, and taking the view that the church will take, that the reason and purpose is more important than the mitzvah itself, could lead to Christian ideas about mitzvot, meaning the church promoted the idea that all the mitzvot have been superseded, right? They existed until their savior came along, and he canceled them. The mitzvot are no longer binding, except the ones that the church decides are binding. But other than that, they're not binding anymore. That's their system. So he says, Sorotkin says, if you're going to engage in reason giving, they're going to tell you, yeah, the reason is more important than the mitzvah. The mitzvah is void. It's really the value behind the mitzvah that you're supposed to retain. So as long as you're a good human being, and let's say on Saturdays you recall God created the world, you don't actually need to observe Shabbat at all. Just follow the reason. He's afraid of playing into Christianity. Moshe, you've been waiting very patiently. Go ahead, please.
It's going to be really brief. Speaking about the Rebbe, there's no such thing as a danger of philosophy. What he's really talking about is a danger of thought, period.
No, I would disagree. He likes thinking. He did a lot of it.
I'm sorry. First of all, there's no such thing as philosophy in Judaism altogether. Because Judaism is so constricted, the notion of philosophy, it's not possible. There's no philosophy that occurs with it. Of course, there's thought. But he's saying, not even thought.
I'm not with you. Sorry. It would be a good debate, you know, what exactly the meaning of philosophy is. I think that's a good question. But no, there's an awful lot of, I mean, thought is definitely there, and even philosophy is there. I'm not with you, Moshe. I'm sorry. Susan. Yeah.
You're telling me this is just the opposite of what I learned for so many years.
What you learned is accurate, and he deals with it in his writing. The concept, Susan is correct that we have a concept in Judaism of a chok, which means a law that is written in stone, it is engraved, and we can't have any explanation for it, we can't understand it, like the law of the red heifer is always the classic example, or Chotanei's is another example. And he addresses that issue. I brought you like tiny excerpt from major issue. There's a lot to be said. But he doesn't dismiss that point. He was also very against messianism. There was a fellow in his day, the prophet of Avila. We read about it already last week. And the question was put to Rabbi Ibn Aderet, can you believe in this guy? And in source number 8, I brought you a piece of his response where he addresses it, and he says, absolutely not. And I'm not going to go into it inside, because we really want to get to see some of Rabbeinu Nisim today. But he says, you can't really seriously believe that this fellow who is illiterate and claims that an angel, a malach, came to him and gave him a book of wisdom and spoke to him and explained stuff and all of that. You can't seriously believe that. Not to mention, prophecy is only in the land of Israel. Prophecy doesn't exist outside of Israel. This guy's not living in Israel. He's living in Spain. He is very much against messianism. But last note on this, and there's so much more to talk about with Rabbi Ibn Aderet, but the last note I wanted to bring on this is source number 9. This comes from a letter he writes to a community rabbi who is in Toledo, who is dealing with immorality in the community. Based on everything that we've read so far, I might have expected that Rabbi Ibn Aderet would say, come down on them like a ton of bricks. You see people acting illegally and unethically? Crush them. And it's not what he does. This is a piece of a longer letter. Take a look at what he says in number 9. This is what I replied to the sage Rabbi Yaakov ben HaKashaf, leader of the yeshiva in Toledo, regarding leading the community and rebuking the sinners. Know, he says, that a soft tongue breaks bones. Know further that one cannot treat all people the same way. And please remember how David, our master and king, ignored what Yoav and Shimei did. Yoav was a general who executed someone inappropriately multiple times. Shimei cursed King David when he was on the run from the rebellion of his son Avshalom, he says, remember how David ignored what they did, even though they were liable for death. For everything has an appointed time, and ignoring the sinner may be a mitzvah at times, all according to the needs of the moment. The sage ignores easily at times. So he says, you can't just make demands, and you can't just come down on people like a ton of bricks. You have to be careful about how you manage the needs of society, and sometimes you have to look the other way, and sometimes you have to speak softly, and you're not always going to win. And I just wanted to conclude with that to show you another side of him, which, again, there's much more, but at least to see that. Okay? Yes, Diane. I can't hear you. You're muted.
Okay.
There you go.
Am I muted?
No, you're fine now.
It would be interesting if he wrote that last response at a later time in his life, or perhaps he learned. He saw that coming down hard on people didn't always work, and he grew himself.
Right. So that's an interesting question. I don't remember when he wrote that. We do find on certain issues that his positions did change over time, on legal issues. I don't know whether this responsum was written later. If I get a chance, I'm going to see if I can find the date on it, because I think it's an interesting question. It is certainly true that when he is being pursued to support that ban on philosophy, it is towards the end of his life. He dies in 1310. 1305 is when the ban finally comes out. He's been pushed on it for years before agreeing to it. So, I wonder about that. Not sure. Okay, let's talk Rabbeinu Nissim.